It's good to have this many back with us on a Sunday evening, and we're thankful that you could be one of those who are with us. We have a good number of kids who've gone to West Kentucky Youth Camp this week, 8 to 10-year-old week, and so pray God's blessings upon them. Also have some of our teens who've gone to Horizons at Fried Harmon, so pray and remember them as well. So a lot of things going on. I want to turn back to the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 6 this evening, thinking about this famous story through the lens of thinking about being good and what it is to do right and to be a guardian in this culture of goodness. When you think about this story, everybody, I think, in this building knows how this story ends. You know that Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. You know that he was not eaten by the lions, but rather his life is going to be preserved. And ultimately, those who were jealous of him, his enemies, are going to be given to the lions. In fact, we've taught this story to our youngest children here at church. And so it's hard for us to ever read Daniel chapter 6 without reading it, knowing the end of the story. And I think that makes it difficult, because then we don't get the tension of the text. We don't get the thought process of really walking as if we were Daniel, because we jump to the end. God's going to work it all out. He's not really going to die. But if you really were to think about what it would be like with fresh eyes to read this story for the first time, never having heard it in our culture before, then how would you look at it? For example, you would probably ask the question, what will our hero do? You've come up through the first five chapters and he's been a great hero. He's interpreted dreams. But now it's at the end of his life. He's an older man, probably in his 60s to 80s. He's been this great prophet of God. And you're wondering, what's Daniel going to do now? Will he be good? Will he be someone who lets his light shine in the face of such darkness? Will he end his life with a climactic stand of faithfulness? Will this be his time to, we might say, stake his claim? I'm righteous, I'm good, and go down to the roar of the lions. Maybe we wonder, will Daniel just have a compromise and just go figure out a way where he doesn't have to get in trouble for praying, or he doesn't get caught praying? You see, we could wonder all those things if we've never read the story. And so I'd like for you to think about the story a little bit as if you've never read it, and if you were Daniel in the story. And so I want to offer four thoughts of this story, for a way of looking at the story, just giving a summary of it in 4 points. And I want you to think about it making his story our story. In the first place, notice that Daniel's jealous enemies conspire to trap him through his faithfulness. In verses 1 through 9, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps. These are officials or leaders. And over them, 3 presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give an account, so that the king might suffer no loss. So he had risen to this highly esteemed government position. He was one of 3 presidents who answered to the king, and then the 120 were below them. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents. He rose to the prominence of the 3 because of an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault, because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in the connection with the law of his God." I want you to observe an important thought in this first section. And that is that Daniel was a man who is described as being faithful. Now, this is not the typical use of the word faithful, because it's used in a non-religious sense. These guys are not talking about his faithfulness to God, but they're talking about his faithfulness to his job. He was a man, it goes on to describe what this faithfulness means, who there was no complaint or any ground of complaint against him. You could not find any error or fault with him. He was a man who was of utmost integrity and honesty. We've got to realize that to be faithful doesn't just mean to be faithful in our attendance or to be faithful to the Lord. But when it comes to faithfulness, it can also be used with our integrity and our character. Daniel was a man who was faithful to his job and to his duties. This faithfulness caused his enemies to be jealous of him. He became distinguished. In fact, he rose to prominence of the three, and so they became jealous of him. This jealousy infused normally rationally thinking people to act irrationally and vindictive in their ways. Really, these other 120 leaders and the other two presidents act irrationally in that they are going to try to deceive the king. Now, if you're in a political position in a kingdom, you, especially the ancient Near East kingdom, where the king is supreme in his authority, you don't want to try to trick and deceive the king. You don't want to get on the wrong side of the king. Of course, they're risking their very lives in trying to put Daniel to death. And ultimately, as you know, once again, you know the end of the story, it's going to cost them their very lives. Daniel's jealous enemies conspire to trap him because of his faithfulness. They begrudge his success and seek to bring about his downfall. And they try to go about it through using his faithfulness to God and through using a religious test. And so they said the only way we can get to him is through his faith. And so they, verse number 7, they come up with a plan to get the king to establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes the petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. This appealed to the king's vanity. Can't pray to anybody but you. They can only petition you. It appealed to his idolatry. And the king, obviously, as we find out later on, did not think about what this meant for his top man that he trusted, Daniel. Notice, secondly, Daniel knew that praying to God was the right thing to do. Read verse 10 with me. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. New King James says, as was his custom. Now, at some point, Daniel had to become aware of the decree. And he could have made a decision that for 30 days, I'm just not going to pray. Or he could have made the decision to do what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, verse 9, and that is, go into your private closet and pray. There's no commandment. It is given an example, and it's referred to some in the Psalms and things that in the Old Testament about them praying toward the temple. Solomon even refers to that when he's initiating the temple and dedicating the temple, that when people throughout all the world pray toward this temple. But it's not required that you pray in an open window toward the temple. That was a matter of custom and practice. Daniel could have thought, I'm going to go low profile on my praying. I mean, after all, why do I need to continue to make a big public spectacle out of this? Why do I need to get in trouble? Let's just wait 30 days, get this over, and then I can go back to praying publicly. But right now, God knows my faith. God knows where I'm at. I'm just going to skip the public prayer time up in the tower in the open window. But I think it's important to note this. There are some times in life when it would not have been a sin in a general sense for Daniel to quit praying. But it would have been a sin for Daniel to quit praying. In other words, Daniel would have been compromising his integrity, his faith, and for him and his conscience. I believe it was wrong for him to quit praying. There was a line drawn in the sand. It's not about praying. It's about, is Daniel going to be faithful? Is Daniel going to exert public faith in God when he knows that public faith in God will lead him to the lion's den? And Daniel could not compromise his faith. If Daniel would have compromised his faith, he would have failed God. He would have failed himself. And he would have sinned. Brethren, sometimes there are things that we can rationalize in our mind and we can say, I know this is not a sin. And we use it, we'll do a little illustration. We'll say, well, if Joe Blow out here, if just anybody, if he were to do that, would that be a sin? And we say, no, it wouldn't be a sin for him to do that or not do that. But we know in our heart of hearts when we're often giving those rationalizations that it's wrong for us, isn't it? That we are compromising our faith. We are not standing up. We're taking the cowardly way out. We're not standing up for what we know is right. Daniel knew that praying to God was the right thing to do. And so for him, he had rather go to the den of lions than he had to go a month without public prayer. The Bible says, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin, James 4:17. For Daniel, such an action would have been a repudiation. He would have been going against his faith. It would have violated his conscience. And it's like they cast the die. They said, Daniel, are you going to really pray? And Daniel said, you dare me, I will still be faithful to God. The next point we notice about this story is Daniel knew that obeying God was more important than obeying men. This is very similar to chapter 2 of the book of Daniel, where they build the great idol to Nebuchadnezzar, the great statue. And in Daniel 3, actually, and they tell everyone that when the music is played, you've got to bow down and worship the image. Daniel's not there at this time, but his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refuse to bow down. And if you remember, they are going to say that it does not matter, O God, whether you does not matter, we are not going to bow down. Let's go back and read that. Notice what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say in Daniel chapter 3. They're told in verse 11, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And verse 12, therefore certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. Nebuchadnezzar was in furious rage. He commanded that these men be brought. He asked them if they were not bowing down. And he tells them again, you've got to bow down. In verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O God. But if not, be it known to you, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. Daniel is, in essence, saying the same thing years later in chapter 6. He's saying, I don't know what God's going to do. And if we're reading this for the first time, we don't know what God's going to do. I don't know if God's going to deliver me or if he's not. But I do know I'm not going to quit praying. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, I don't know if God's going to deliver us or not, but I know one thing. I'm not going to bow down and worship that image. Daniel knew that obeying God was more important than obeying men. And so Daniel says in chapter 6, Daniel went up, got down on his knees, and prayed. Then they go and they remind the king of these things. And the king answered in verse number 12, the second part of that verse, the thing stands fast according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, notice similar language to chapter 3, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes petition three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed, set his mind to deliver Daniel, and he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establish can be changed. Daniel was determined that he was going to pray. He was not going to allow the commandment of men to change him obeying the commands of God. The fourth part of this story is, of course, what we all know. So if we're reading this with fresh eyes, we are now drawn up with nerves. We're anxious. What's going to happen? Is Daniel going to be put to death? Is God going to deliver him? Is the king going to find a way out? We have been assured of Daniel's goodness, of Daniel's integrity. Would he maintain it to the end? Well, of course, as we read the rest of the story, Daniel is thrown in. The king will go and will, verse 18, the king went to his palace, spent the night fasting, no diversions were brought to him, and he was not able to sleep. Verse 19, at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. He came near to the den where Daniel was. He cried out in a tone of anguish. And the king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him. And also before you, O king, I have done no harm. The den of lions involves the grace of God being displayed to Daniel. If you think about the analogy here of how we in this world, 1 Peter 5:8, Satan is prowling about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Satan's trying to eat us up. He's trying to devour us. You and I give way to sin sometimes. We fall short. But God has delivered us by his grace. He has saved us by the blood of his Son. Daniel is delivered because of the grace of God. When we become so comfortable with the children's version of this story, we forget what it must have felt like to be Daniel. Imagine the nerves. He did not know if he was going to be delivered. being thrown to a den of lions, to vicious, hungry lions, thinking that you were near death, all because you prayed publicly, all because you prayed and were faithful to what God said. Now notice, the Bible attests to many other times when God chose not to intervene and to allow His servants to experience suffering and death. In fact, the book of Revelation, the book of Acts, James has his head cut off while Peter is delivered the very night he is waiting to have his head cut off. God sometimes intervenes, sometimes He does not in the Bible. Daniel did not know, but Daniel maintained his faith, and he's a great example of how we've got to maintain our faith and do what is right even when we don't know how it's going to turn out. There's four lessons that we can take from this story. The first lesson, and all these are about goodness and being good. We need guardians of goodness in our culture of tolerance and wickedness today. When we think about goodness, talking about doing good works, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, we are created in Christ Jesus for good works. Even today, good works will make the news headlines sometimes. They'll make a paper telling about some good effort that's been done. Brethren, we ought to be people who are not doing things to get in the paper and make the news headlines, but that ought to be a part of our daily life, to be doing good works. Christ calls us to let our light shine before others that they may see our good works, Matthew 5:16. We are to be zealous for good works, Titus chapter 2 and verse 14. In a world of darkness, God needs you to be a light, a guardian for goodness in your circle of influence. We need people who stand up and say, it's the right thing to do, and I'm going to do what's right. Secondly, notice that the primary challenge of goodness is a willingness to be good in the face of overt conflict and oppression. Y'all are all doing something good tonight. You are worshiping. You're at church. It's good. How many of you would be here? Would your preacher be here? If we knew if we got caught tonight, we'd be put in prison. Changes the question, doesn't it? That's why it is easy to do good things when there's no pressure or there's no conflict. There's no oppression. But obviously, it gets hard to do the right thing when there is perceived oppression, rejection, social anxiety, peer pressure. Goodness is easy. It gets really hard to do when you feel like you're going to have ramifications for doing it. You see, really when you find out, I guess we could ask it like this. How many years had Daniel prayed three times a day and it wasn't any issue? Maybe for 50 years. I mean, he could have done this for years, month after month, day after day, he could have done this. But I have to believe that after that law was passed, the first morning, he went to that prayer room, to that window, and faced toward Jerusalem. It was with nerves in his knees and a trembling voice that he bowed down. Had to be a lot different, didn't it? And that's the same way it is for us. I don't know what it is in your life, but there is going to be something that you will often do good, and you'll take comfort in, I can do that easy, that's a good thing to do. And somehow Satan, and it might be years from now, a habit you have, but Satan will put a stumbling block and he'll try to tempt you to oppress you, cause tension or conflict in a relationship, cause peer pressure, cause you to feel like, if I do that, if I continue to do that, it's going to cause conflict. And that's where the proverbial fork in the woods is, isn't it? Where you've got to make that decision. Which road am I going to take? Goodness is really only, it's really only seen the most when it is surrounded by darkness. You know, we love the stories of people saving the Jewish people from the Nazis in World War II. Movies like Schindler's List, other stories that have come out in the last 60 years of people that had saved numerous Jews. The Diary of Anne Frank in that story. Numerous, you know, stories. What makes those stories so remarkable? What makes the stories remarkable about the Underground Railroad in America of people delivering people from slavery and things? It's not that they were doing an act that was good. Feeding some Jewish people wasn't that big an act in the 1920s. But in the 1930s, saving and harboring and feeding Jewish people in Nazi Germany became an act that could get you killed. Goodness is seen when we face oppression if we do it. I'm not a prophet, not a son of a prophet. But brethren, we need to be raising our children up to know that lesson. Because I think in America, we're going to be challenged. Are we going to be good? Are we going to stand up for what's right as darkness encroaches more upon our Christian values and upon the church and upon the truth? Number three, our goodness must be seen as directly tied to our faithfulness in spiritual life. When you read debates between atheists and Christians, they'll usually bring this up, the atheists will. And that is, atheists have this idea that they really want to put out there that they're not bad people. In other words, they're good people to have as neighbors. And they'll talk about, you know, we want to be good citizens and we want to help our communities and we care about the poor and we care about things like that. And If you're a neighbor to us, we'll bring you food if you're sick. We care about doing good things. And the Christian apologist always wants to remind and make the point that Christians have never claimed that we have a sole license to goodness. God created goodness and has allowed humans to do goodness all throughout various religions. It's a part of our human nature. We want to do good for others and we want to do acts of love for others. We have capacity to love and to cherish and those kind of things. But brethren, the kind of goodness I'm saying is that we ought to do good. The difference, and here's the difference between the atheist and the Christian. The atheist does good because it gives him a good warm feeling. He feels like it's something he wants to do to help out someone and it makes him feel good and he wants other people to help him. A Christian does good because of who our God is. This is why a Christian is compelled to love his enemies, even though they are his enemies. You see, the difference in an atheist doing good and a Christian doing good is the motives behind why you do the good. You can do good as a Christian, and it may not give you always a good warm feeling. Or it may even, in the case of what we were just talking about, even lead to conflict or oppression. But you can still take faith and hope and comfort because you know that God knew you did good. God is the rewarder of those deeds you've done. And so our goodness must be seen as directly tied to our faithfulness and spiritual life. Notice that Daniel his goodness was connected with his faith. He was a man of integrity, hard work, and that came because of his faith. What an honor it is for them to say about Daniel, the only way we can get to him is through his faith. Wouldn't that be a compliment to each one of us? The only thing that we can ever pin against him is that he is someone who is dedicated to the Word of God, to the truth of God, to the principles of God. His faith. For example, evangelism, prayer, and even rebuking a wayward brother are good works. But our world may not see them as good works. But a Christian understands that we do good as it is defined by God. And if we're doing what God says, then it's good. Even if the world doesn't see it as good, or if the world doesn't understand why we do that. And so we must always try to connect our goodness with our faith. Let me give you one practical challenge on that. When you do a good deed for someone, whether it's taking food to a neighbor who's sick, dropping by and meeting a newcomer in your area, whatever you do that's good, try to connect that with your faith. Not in a showy, kind of holier-than-thou attitude, but if you take food to a neighbor who's sick, drop a little verse in there with the food. Drop an invitation to church. Here's our bulletin. We'd like for you to come to church with me sometime. Connect it in, because here's the thing. Everybody does goodness. They do. The Muslims do good things. They have people that do good things in the Muslim world, and the Hindus and the atheists. All those people are doing good things, quote, good things. You do good things, but don't do it just because you're a good neighbor, a good person. Do it because of your faith. Because of your faith. And last, our goodness must not be defined by the outcome of our actions. We like to evaluate goodness. We rank what is the most good we can do. While this may be necessary, we must realize that we should do goodness many times simply because it's the right thing to do. You cannot base your choice of doing goodness on the likely outcome. If Daniel would have based his goodness on the outcome, he would not have prayed. So when you think about doing a good act, don't think about what's the outcome going to be. Many times, you won't even really know the full outcome. And don't think, well, this is not going to really have a very big impact, so I'm not going to do it. I think about the man, the young boy, who had the loaves and the fish. He could have thought, what difference is this going to make? It's not very much. How's it going to feed the multitude? But those loaves and fish in the hands of Jesus were multiplied into feeding the thousands. You never know what God will do with your small act of goodness. Don't base doing a good act on the outcome. If Daniel would have based it on the outcome, he probably would have thought, I'm not doing this. This is going to be bad news. We need to understand that we do good for the sake of doing good and for the sake of God. This evening, if you're not a child of God, I hope that you'll think about your goodness and how you can serve God more through good acts and through standing up for what's right in a culture of darkness. If you need to put Christ on in baptism, if we can help you and assist you in that, if you need to rededicate your life, please come as together we stand and as we sing.